Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the NBC Newsroom in New York, ready to call in our correspondents at home and abroad with the news of the world. We take you first to the Russian capital for the report of Robert Magidov. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magidov speaking from Moscow. It's obvious to anyone that should Stalingrad fall soon, the Germans will launch a major offensive against Moscow on the one hand and against Baku on the other. But the Russians are convinced that Hitler's plans linked with the hoped-for fall of Stalingrad are more far-reaching. They include schemes of enticing or threatening other powers, now still friendly or neutral, into joining the Axis in its struggle against Russia. The heroic defense of Stalingrad, said official Pravda, wrecked all such plans. Therefore, the city must be held at all costs for considerations of international policy as well as for other reasons. This would help Russia to retain its guns and to prevent neutrals from caring to the enemy. The whole world is watching the battle for Stalingrad, said Pravda, and cited a Turkish paper to the effect that Stalingrad is resisting with greater retaliating force and strengthness than the whole of Europe. The Russians are resolved to hold Stalingrad until the time for a counteroffensive comes, possibly simultaneous with the launching of a second front of Europe. With this in mind, Stalingrad is fighting back and is amassing forces to hold at any cost. A meeting of leading communist party officials of the Stalingrad province assured the defenders that the farmers and workers of the unoccupied part of the province will keep the city going. At the same time, the Russian pressure from the northwest shows no signs of threatening. Stalingrad must hold, but will hold. This is the strength of the defenders. The perfect example of a city that has settled down to a long siege is Leningrad. The battles continue around it on water, on land, and in the air, and the city is still being bombarded by long range artillery. But old sedate Leningrad is living with nothing amid the madness of war. Today, a number of messages reached me from Leningrad showing something of the daily round there. Here, for instance, some of the things that took place in the city yesterday. An exhibition opened showing how private dwellings ought to prepare for the coming cold winter. A new contingent of young bricklayers, electricians, and other handymen attended graduation exercises for the city industrial training school. Baltic Seaman of the Navy Club held a reception for a group of writers and poets. And 21-year-old and polite itself won the Platinum Championship in 1942. Goodbye from Moscow.
And now for the latest developments in Britain, we take you to Alex Dreyer in London.
This is Alex Dreyer reporting from London. Majority opinion as expressed in the British press this morning is that the Goering speech of yesterday was by far the most important delivered by any Nazi this year. Insofar as Hitler's gargantua stressed the home front, the opinion is easy to follow. The Nazis are acutely conscious of the fact that the collapse of the home front in the last war shattered the Hohenzollern dreams of world conquest. The Marshal's bombastic claims of an abundance of food in Germany are viewed here as but a Nazi lure to attract additional workers from the occupied and satellite countries. Too many holes, apparently, have been blasted in the Reich's industrial machine by the world's toughest realist. The locust ravaging of the overrun countries undoubtedly is responsible for Goering's easiness on the subject of food. Reports filtering into the Norwegian government in exile here in London reveal that as a result of such pillaging of food stocks, what amounts to a state of famine is evident in a number of Norwegian districts. Women fainting in food queues is now a common sight, and in the factories, workers are said to be collapsing under the pressure of long hours at their benches. Norway is not an isolated case, but typical of any of the occupied countries, as reports here only too clearly reveal. In view of the Hitler, Goebbels, Goering, and Ribbentrop speeches of this week, Britain's Minister of Information has reiterated that one of the first war aims of the United Nations is the personal punishment of such international criminals. The British press front pages this morning, the letter directed by Premier Stalin to Henry Cassidy of the Associated Press on the question of a second front. Significantly, the British press does not comment, merely printing the letter in full. The Cassidy questions, Stalin's answers. The BBC also, without comment, reported the contents of the letter in its evening broadcast. Interesting to note that Britain's Minister of Information commented last night that this government is endeavoring to provide the hard-pressed Russians with as much relief as is possible. And he adds, I give the assurance that I know what I'm talking about. Over the weekend, a million London women registered for firewatch duty. In Coventry to Coventry, Miss Ellen Wilkinson, Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Home Security, defended the conscription of women for such duty, adding the women who complain against the same for lack of shopping time should have their husbands get the groceries. Then, says Miss Wilkinson, they'll realize what a woman has to do. Taking advantage of the shortage of accommodations, London's Daily Herald categorically states that racketeering and overcharging in rents of houses, flats, furnished and unfurnished rooms is going on all over the country. Victims of this bootleg in rents appear to be mostly war workers and servicemen's wives. Local authorities have the power to prevent such bootlegging, providing the tenants concerned register their complaints. And now, this is Alex Dreyer in London, returning you to New York.
We turn next to the Southwest Pacific, and in just a moment we shall have a report of one of our correspondents in Australia. Come in, Australia.
This is George Thomas Foster speaking from Australia. Good news continues to come from New Guinea. Today it is officially confirmed that Australian troops have passed through Ifoji. This native village is important, for it is only about 7.5 miles below and south of the gap in the Owen Stanley Range. As distances in New Guinea are more often considered in time, in hours, rather than in miles, we can figure that our troops are now within about 8 hours' travel of their original defense line in the Jungle Mountains. In about 1 week's steady advance, the Australian ground forces have retaken just about every foot the Japs gained during the final 3 weeks of their drive towards Port Moresby. Now from Ifoji to Hellfire Pass, as the Aussies have christened it, the Allied drive northward must be made up two heartbreaking trails, which rise steeply for 2,000 feet in these last 7.5 miles. Naturally, this elevation and terrain favor the Japs, who may select just this point to go on the defensive. In the 28 miles they have been chasing the Japs since last Tuesday, that is, since they took Yuribaiwa, the Australians have found no signs of any prepared defenses. Today's official communique from headquarters here once more reports that our fighters strafed key points along the enemy's line of retreat. This is the first time that headquarters has referred to an enemy's line of retreat. Until today's communique, previous ones, when dealing with information about our pilots' air operations in New Guinea, always referred to the enemy's supply line. Although the communique goes no further, gives no additional hint beyond this reference to the enemy's line of retreat, we can perhaps interpret this to mean that headquarters is now willing to consider the falling back operation of the enemy as a full-scale retreat. Of course, it would as yet be unwise to speculate too far on the purpose of the enemy's action. Many competent observers, both at the scene of action and here at Southwest Pacific Headquarters, seem to feel that the Japs certainly won't run all the way out of New Guinea without at least another fight for it. Such a withdrawal following Milne Bay would be a severe loss of faith. Since our forces have pushed on to within striking distance of the gap, it now would seem that the only other alternative for the enemy is to dig in and make a stand on the top of the 6,200-foot range. But to dig in and make a stand means that supplies must be kept flowing up to the front line. The Jap has already had a stomach full of this, of trying to keep food and medicine, ammunition and arms supplied to men crawling through trackless, tangled jungle, while our fighters and bombers mow them down and blast to pieces the forest around them. A stand here at the gap shouldn't mean much, with our airmen still able to bomb blast the Jap supply lines without challenge from a single enemy fighter. This is George Thomas Holster, speaking from Australia.
The latest developments in our own national capital are reported by Richard Harkness, speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
Now that the inflation bill's out of the way, the most important news in Washington this morning is manpower and the fact that we're dangerously short of workers. We're so short-handed, as a matter of fact, that some of our more responsible officials are beginning to wonder. They're beginning to ask if we can raise an army of 10 to 13 million men and still produce the munitions and food we must turn out if the United States is going to be the arsenal of democracy. So let's look at this manpower problem for just a moment. Now, the best figures the government has, they show that there are only 60 million men and women in the country capable of really effective production. Only 60 million persons able to do our fighting, who can mine our metal and produce our raw materials. Only 60 million persons to maintain transportation facilities and keep our communications and utilities and maintain civilian life. Out of those 60 million effectives, the draft will take at least 10 million for the armed forces by the end of next year. That leaves 50 million here at home. And according to General Hershey, it takes at least 5 men or women to produce the weapons one soldier fights with, to grow and process the food a single soldier eats, and to make what he wears. So that accounts for all our 60 million effective persons, 10 million in the armed forces, and 50 million working to supply them. Those figures make it plain why some officials here are beginning to wonder if the United States should have an army of 10 million men. Because, they point out, this country must do more, must do a lot more than merely keep our own army in the field. For under Lend-Lease, we're trying to supply the British with food and bombers and tanks. We've made heavy commitments to Russia. We've pledged help for China. And while we're cutting our civilian needs to the bone, we still must feed and clothe and house our people here at home. Now, four of us, four radio and newspaper men, were sitting around the dinner table the other night with a prominent official. After we'd been talking about manpower for a while, this official told us to glance around the crowded restaurant. You know, he said, this manpower problem is going to make a big change in our way of living. Because, he went on, before very long, certainly before next year is out, at least 3 out of 4 men between 18 and 45, and maybe up to 65, will be drafted into the army, or they'll be conscripted for direct war work of some kind or the other. And the women have their war work cut out, too. This government official estimated that 1 out of every 3, or possibly 1 out of every 4 American women between 18 and 45, will be in uniform or in overalls before the end of 1943. There's only one answer to this manpower problem, and that's government conscription of labor. It's putting it mildly to say that Congress isn't keen about the proposition, so there'll be no action until after the November elections. But Congress might as well make up its mind to draft men and women to work as well as to fight. Because the pressing shortage of farm workers makes it plain today that action can't wait much longer. So we may get action this week, for the Senate Military Affairs Committee has scheduled hearings on 2 national service bills. And there's other important news today. A House committee has spent 2 weeks investigating the quality of American fighter planes, and it announces this morning that United States Army planes are better by 7-1 than the best the Axis has been able to send against them. And Mr. Roosevelt has decided that, after all, he'll support John J. Bennett, who's the Democratic nominee for governor in New York State. The president, you'll remember, tried to get the nomination for Senator Meade, but now he's come out for John J. Bennett. And that's all from Washington.
You have been listening to the News of the World, reported by our correspondents at home and overseas. We heard this morning from Robert Magadoff in Moscow, Alex Dreyer in London, George Thomas Folster in Australia, and Richard Harkness in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Good evening, everyone. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer and bringing you the news of the world. An official communique just released draws a picture of unrelenting and of ruthless warfare in the Solomons. The persistent Japs, the Navy admits, do steadily manage under cover of the equatorial darkness to land small bodies of troops along the coasts of Guadalcanal Island. Those forces dribbling over the mountains and through the silent forests then converge toward our aerodrome, Henderson Field, and the green woods crackle with gunfire as opposing patrols meet in bitter combats. Our position, though, has been maintained, and our flyers have strewn constant havoc among the Jap ships which still infest those waters. At least one more enemy destroyer has been hit. During the same recent period at the topside of the Pacific, U.S. Army bombers are reported as now making almost daily raids on the uncomfortable invaders of Kisker Island in the Aleutians. 5 Nipponese seaplanes, the favorite craft of the Japs in that airfieldless area, have been shot down, and 2 cargo vessels which were hit the other day by our bombs have been beached, obviously to keep them from going to the bottom. And now a word from Charles Lyon.
This takes only about 41 seconds, but it's for you who have a headache, that mean little ailment that can seem so big at times. It's simply this. For prompt relief, take Alka-Seltzer. Now, you probably already know what Alka-Seltzer can do for, say, occasional acid indigestion. So try it, too, for your headache. Alka-Seltzer's pain-relieving analgesic, sodium acetyl salicylate, is especially effective because it is already dissolved when you take it and is also guarded by valuable alkalinizing buffers. Try Alka-Seltzer for the truly fast relief it can give. All druggists have it in 30 and 60 cent size packages. And now, the news of the world.
In the high New Guinea mountains, the Japanese retreat continues. For 7 days now, the Australian ground forces, who are based on that hot and strategically important little town of Port Moresby, have driven the Japs backward and upward, which is the hardest kind of military operation, toward the crest of the Owen Stanley Range. If the Allied counter thrust goes on with the same momentum, the invaders will very soon be forced to stagger downward over the far side of that great land barrier. That is good news and important news on several different counts. Moresby, once no more than a roasting little tropic town on a bare and stricken promontory, is now a first-class military base, probably not a very comfortable one, for port in these last 6 months has had more than its share of bombing. The less than 100 red iron warehouses and white bungalows perched up on concrete piles to discourage termites have many of them been knocked to pieces. Moresby has no water supply. All its inhabitants ever had to drink or wash in was what fell on individual roofs in the seasons of heavy rainfall, plus a little extra which was caught on literally a small tin-covered and white-painted hillside just behind the governor's bungalow office. Those roofs and that hillside water catchment today are badly battered. But port nowadays has more white, male, and able inhabitants than ever before in its history. And the only town and the only safe ship anchorage on 1,000 miles of Papua's south coast has been widely spread, generally transformed and held. Though its danger is not vanished, it has been indefinitely postponed. What is almost as much to the point, though, is that it looks as if there as in the Solomon, our fighters had at last learned how to meet and beat the Asiatic enemy at his own peculiar game, that game of deadly secret jungle infiltration. Disregarding the one known trail, the Japs filtered up and over a series of steep hills and steeper ravines, which had been thought impassable. But we have learned to filter right back at them and have sent them scampering, leaving many of their supplies behind them. For one thing, the Australians, we are told, have now been cured of our Allied obsession for khaki in all climates and are wearing green instead. But what also seems to have happened is that our fighters have the help of many friendly native Papuan porters who are giving their help in carrying loads over those steep trails. And the brutal Japs have lost that precious help. And now let's hear from our London reporter, who is now standing by in Britain with the latest news from that war capital. Come in, Alex Dreyer in London.
This is Alex Dreyer reporting from London. Premier Stalin's letter on the obligations of the United Nations to Russia has received a full airing here, in the press and on the radio. But significantly, comment is practically nil. The phrase, on time, has captivated the imagination of Britons, causing them to wonder if a timetable had been agreed upon during Churchill's visit to the Kremlin. Several members of Parliament have already said they will put that question to the Prime Minister at the next sitting of Commons. 2 unofficial but connected views have been expressed here in London on the letter, and here they are for what they're worth. One, Stalin is turning on a little heat of his own. Two, irrespective of that heat, neither this country or the United States will allow themselves to be stampeded into something which, as of the present, is apparently not considered militarily feasible. It cannot be reiterated too often from here that the people of Britain and their leaders are just as anxious as the Russians for the opening of a second front. They fully realize that the successful maintenance of the first front is dependent upon the establishment of the second. But they are just as conscious of the fact that ill planning and timing of the second front could result in the eventual collapse of the first. The people on this island are content to let the men who are going to fight and die in that venture be the ones to decide when it should be opened. The government winds up its debate on the rationing of fuel sometime this week. And popular Sir Stafford Cripps, the leader of the House, is in a spot no one envies. A few months back, he expressed compulsory rationing as the government policy and could not agree to the system of voluntary rationing, which now is part of the government plan. So this week, he'll be arguing the case he so vigorously opposed in the previous debate. The American soldiers over here are really seeing things, seeing everything from the pubs to Buckingham Palace and the Tower of London. That some of them are able to see as much as they do is because 23 London policemen are spending their spare time acting as guides for the inquisitive Yanks. The most popular guide is a war reserve cop who provides his own buggy, which the Texans especially like because it's got, as they put it, a little bounce. Recently, American Army authorities warned the men of the phony guides who charge as much as $12 a tour. None of the London police guides charge more than 20 cents. A few days ago, several of the guides said they'd like to instruct their soldier friends in the British game of darts. When the lesson was over, the Americans were without any cash. They then promptly taught their guides the art of penny pitching. And that lesson, too, was successful. And since that time, there's been a rapid exchange of national currencies. And now, this is Alex Dreyer in London, taking you to Upton Close in Chicago.
Day and night, we are pounding the Japs in Kiska and Attu and Agatu, which last means in the Aleut language, little Attu. But I would add to John Vandercook's comment that the North Pacific battle has only just begun. It is to be remembered that the Japanese are in Kiska at the end of a very well-conducted supply line that comes direct from Japan's factories by way of the Kuril Island chain, which runs northwest from Japan proper. And they're much nearer to great production centers than are our outposts in Agatu and in that direction. Interest in Asia proper centers on Wendell Willkie's visit in Chongqing. He made one interesting statement. It's come over the press wires. It's a little bit vernacular. Quote, "The one contribution that I want to make is to howl and howl that all nations must be free to seek their own just aspirations. Madam Chiang Kai-shek and I are going to howl for the right kind of world when this war is over." We're used to Wendell Willkie speaking in rather guttural terms, Madam Chiang Kai-shek's very fine speech. But when he says howl, he undoubtedly means put things forcefully. That statement seems to be in conflict, notably today, with a reported statement from Harold Macmillan, Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for the Colonies in London. He's reported to have said, quote, "For material purposes of war and peace, we need the colonies. We need their mineral and agricultural resources in war, and we need their opportunities for our trade in peace." He says the colonies have been won by individual men and heroism, and they must be even more prodigally expended in the future, and to shuffle off responsibilities or to abandon them would be a great refusal, a great abdication, and a great crime. Just how these two statements are going to be made to jibe and to fit with the Atlantic Charter still remains to be seen. We have a very pathetic and heroic story from New Delhi about a contingent of Chinese troops that arrived out of Burma and have been put in a newly conducted American training school in India. The Chinese lost 4,000 of their men in all, 3,000 of them getting away from the enemy, 1,000 getting into India out of Burma in the face of the monsoon rains, which were said to be furious. These people are now being trained by Americans to go back and fight for their land. And from Chicago, we turn to Morgan Beatty in Washington.
Well, Upton Close, there's a little confusion on the domestic American front. Now that the president has come out for Bennett for governor in New York State, it's high time to take note of this confusion, and possibly we can piece out of it a definite trend toward unity within the Democratic Party, a trend spearheaded by Mr. Roosevelt himself. Last week, when he came back home from his transcontinental tour, the chief executive made a special point of telling the newsmen about his old friend down in Texas, Cactus Jack Garner. It seems that the presidential train happened to pass through Uvalde, Texas, and Cactus Jack drove down to the station in his old coupe. They smoked a peace pipe for a spell, and the special roared on. Then on Saturday, when the president picked an economic czar for the country, he grabbed a loyal supporter in Jimmy Burns from South Carolina. But he also got a man highly thought of by all senators, and a man who can get along with the conservative wings of all parties. You might say the president was tendering an olive branch to the diehards. And today, Wright Patman got up in the House to talk about the Constitution. Now, Wright Patman is a constitutional lawyer who wears no New Deal collar. He's got one of his own, a pretty horrible 1890 affair, to be exact. But he said, in effect, that Congress had better come to its senses and quit fighting the commander-in-chief, for that's what any president is in wartime, and it's a duty imposed upon him by the Constitution. All of these developments would seem to be straws in the wind. The president has completely reversed his political field since 1938. Then he went out after conservative Democrats in his famous and unsuccessful purge. But now, he's made his peace with Cactus Jack. He's got a constitutional lawyer arguing his case, and a darn good case, in the House. He accepts the Tidings bill to curb inflation. Tidings, the man who tried to purge 4 years ago. Practical observers hereabouts suspect the president has two purposes in mind. First, national unity. He must have that to get us on the winning side of this war. And second, Democratic Party unity. He must have that to keep the Democrats from taking a pretty stiff licking in November. Speaker Rayburn of the House today grudgingly admitted that the Democrats were going to have to make a fight of it to hold their own in Congress this year. He agreed with a recent Gallup poll, the one that figured out the way the Democrats are suffering. It said the losses of the Democrats would be determined by the size of the November vote, and that the vote would be smaller than usual. The reason for this is the fact that the upper crust, that would be the Republicans, votes heavier in an off year. There are more Democrats along the lower crust of the voting pie. And that's all from Washington for now.
More news in a moment. Meanwhile, here's something about that all-important subject of vitamins. The Miles Laboratories, makers of Alka-Seltzer, make two vitamin products under the brand name of One A Day. They are One A Day brand vitamin A and D tablets in the yellow box, and One A Day brand vitamin B complex tablets in the gray box. And you can quickly recognize them by the big numeral 1 on each package. The so-called cod liver oil vitamins, those in the yellow box, are One A Day brand vitamin A and D tablets. And to get not only your minimum daily requirements of these two necessary vitamins, but actually 25% more, you take only one tablet once a day. That's all, just one tablet once a day. One A Day vitamin A and D tablets are pleasant tasting. There's no fishy, oily taste and no aftertaste. And they are most economical because you take only one tablet a day. Ask your druggist for One A Day brand vitamin A and D tablets. And give one tablet a day to every member of your family. Remember, it's the brand with the big one on the package. Now, back to the newsroom.
Moscow reports at midnight Soviet troops have improved their positions above Stalingrad, and 1,500 more Nazis have been killed in the repulse of heavy attacks inside the city itself. And that's the news of the world. This is John W. Vandercook speaking for Alka-Seltzer and repeating at Washington's request this urgent invitation. The Army asks repairmen and mechanical specialists of all categories to volunteer for service. Technical experts are badly needed to lend the use of their skilled hands to Uncle Sam. So, until tomorrow at this same time, goodbye from the newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.